Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Go back to Mississippi, said Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Go back to Alabama. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Well, back in the summer of 63, the civil rights leader was telling marchers in Washington to return to their homes with the hope that lives would be changed and that King's dream of an integrated America would come true. But go back to Georgia appears to mean something else today. That was one of the discoveries made by the Harvard writer and academic Henry Louis Gates Jr. when he took a PBS television crew on a tour of what's now called America Beyond the Color Line. In exploring the social and financial success of African Americans today, Gates meets a generation of middle and upper class black Americans who are returning to the South, who are living well and living apart in neighborhoods that are almost all African American. What's your perspective on what's happening behind or beyond the color line? Do you see a new segregation in this country where whites and African Americans at the same class level are choosing to live in homes apart rather than together? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And the four-part PBS series that's written and hosted by Professor Gates can be seen in your area most likely on the 2nd and the 3rd, 3rd and the 4th of February. Check your local PBS station for broadcast details in case there's a shift, and we'll have a link to PBS on our own website where you can see more about the film work that's being done. We're at The Connection. My guest this hour, chair of Harvard's African and African American Studies Department, Henry Louis Gates Jr. Nice to have you back.
Thanks for having me on your program.
I was surprised to see at the beginning of your trip to the South to have you say that you were afraid to go to the South. I think that's the word that you use. You're just kind of like unsettled about going to the South because of its history.
Are you kidding? When I was growing up, I was born in 1950. What was the South for us? The South was a litter of corpses and crosses. The South was my nightmare. And the idea that that I would ever go to the South.
But you're from the West Hills of Virginia, right?
Yeah, I'm from the eastern part of West Virginia.
Okay.
West by God, Virginia, which, remember, seceded from Virginia over slavery in 1863. I always looked north. You know, black culture is full of stories and songs with the leitmotif of which is follow the North Star. Nobody ever said follow the Southern Cross. You know, we did not migrate from the North to the South.
But you are a guy who, since you went to Yale in 1969 with that crew of 100 other black students, that sort of vanguard, you call them. And, mm-hmm. I mean, since that moment, you have been studying and examining and thinking about the place of African Americans in this country. So to get in the car and head south out of Washington, to take that camera into Memphis and Atlanta, I think you'd be out in front of the car. Let's go. But you're going, hey, this is strange.
As it turns out, I was quite excited to go. You see, my daughter, one of the reasons I was interested in this, remember, we have a four-part show, and I wanted to devote 1 hour to this phenomenon. But I got the idea from my younger daughter, Liza, two daughters, Maggie and Liza Gates. And Liza...
she's at Spelman in Atlanta,
yeah,
right?
She's at Spelman. She just transferred to NYU, but she spent 3 years at Spelman. And she only applied to Spelman. I mean, much to her mother and father's chagrin. I mean, she didn't apply to any other school. Right. I mean, we were going crazy, you know, hoping that she got in. But she wanted to go south. You know, this is a child who was born in the Yale New Haven Hospital, lived on college camp, lived in New Haven, lived in Ithaca, New York when my wife and I were at Cornell. Then we both were at Duke. And then in Harvard Square, in Lexington, then Harvard Square.
Lots of ivy in that child's background.
That's right. But she wanted to go to an elite black women's college to be with other African-American women who were achieving. And that is, in small, an example of what people like the Wolfs, people like Morgan Freeman, people like Maya Angelou, all of whom are in my documentary, what they want to do with their careers and with their lives. They want to go home, as Maya Angelou put it. This is our home, she told me in an incredible interview. And our people have been in exile for 100 years since the migration started in the early part of the 20th century. So I wanted to not only record that curious phenomenon, but ironize it. You know, at the end I ask, would Dr. King have approved of this? I mean, Dr. King said, go back to Mississippi. He said, go back and vote and change it. But the idea that people long gone, as we say, from the South, would then go back, not to integrate white neighborhoods, say in Buckhead in Atlanta, but to start all black communities. And mind you, these communities, as you saw in the film, consist of million-dollar homes, all black country clubs, all black Jack and Jills, all black swimming pools. It made me, I first heard of them when my barber, Bernard Hicks, right here in Cambridge, went down on vacation to Atlanta, and he calls me, Doc. I was sitting in the chair, he's, you know, shaving away my naps, and he said, Doc, I'm gonna move to Atlanta. I said, Bernard, you can't move to Atlanta. I can't commute, man. You need to cut my hair. I said, why? He said, black people in nice homes with lawns, with SUVs, with BMWs, their kids fresh and going to college, wanting to go to Harvard, wanting positive role models all around you. I've never, he said, seen anything like it. And it is astonishing when you go to Atlanta and see it.
Let's hear a little bit of this. You're talking to the actor Morgan Freeman about his decision to buy a home and live where his family comes from in Charleston, Mississippi.
This is home. This is where my roots are. This is where my parents are buried. This is where I've always felt safest.
But what is it about the South that's different for a black person than the North or the West?
I think we built the South, and we know it. I do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, what I own in the South isn't because I went and bought it. What I own is my place there.
This is where I have always felt safest, he says.
And I looked at him like, are you whistling Dixie? I thought he was going to give me a wink or not. Because we have felt most vulnerable as a people, traditionally, in the South. The North, Boston, Rochester, New York City, Philadelphia. These were the places where the slaves fled, starting in the 18th and 19th centuries. And now, at the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st century, our people are, as Morgan Freeman put it, and Maya Angelou put it so eloquently, they're coming home. Quite remarkable.
One of the couples that you meet in the documentary is Deirdre and, I have to flip back, and Gerald Wolf, who have a home in Georgia.
Oh, wonderful people. So sensitive, so intelligent. Just good people.
Are you loving this, Deirdre, as you're listening?
Yes.
Hey, Deirdre, how you doing?
Fine. How are you?
I'm fine.
Good.
I was looking at the book that Professor Gates put together, Deirdre, and in that he quotes you even in greater length than you appear in the PBS documentary. And you tell this story about how your son in Michigan was frequently the only African-American boy in a particular classroom. And all of a sudden in Georgia, he's in a classroom that's quite different. What does he see now?
What he sees is many other black children who are intelligent, who are interested in achieving. It was interesting because race is such a larger part of the education process here. In Michigan, he was the only black child in his class all the way through the fifth grade. And they made no bones about it. No one ever discussed it. As soon as I got here and we were in the application process, one of the things that the counselor assured me is that he would never be the only black child in his classroom.
But tell me a little bit about the neighborhood where you live, Deirdre. How far down the street would you have to go left or right to find a white family living in your neighborhood?
China.
I have no idea. I've never walked that far. But we came from a predominantly white subdivision in West Bloomfield, Michigan. There were 9 black families, and of course, we knew each other quite well. One of our objectives was to have a different experience. Not so much for my husband and myself, because we were both born and raised in black communities, but we wanted our children in a black community. And so coming to Atlanta, we said, well, why not? If we're going to live in a black community, this is where we need to do it.
Now, let me just stop you there, Deirdre, because it's at that point in the documentary when Professor Gates just says, now, wait a minute. Is this, what was the question that you put to her about whether or not this is, in fact, what Dr. King had in mind? Or if isn't this some kind of reverse?
Yeah, I asked her and her husband, isn't this reminiscent of the language that white people used in the early 60s to keep us out of the neighborhood? So we want to share a common culture. We want to share certain values. We're not sure that they will be comfortable. And we all laughed. And, of course, It's similar, but Deidre said it was different too.
Yes, I did. I said it's different because we're not forced into segregated areas.
Mm-hmm.
We can choose among being in an integrated area because we have many friends that are in Alpharetta and in Buckhead, and then those of us who prefer are in Southwest Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. It's the difference between enforced segregation and willing association.
Right.
One is willing, one is unwilling. One is mandated by law, and one is mandated by heart, by desire.
But one of the big things, Deirdre, that I'm sure you'll agree that has changed and that allows you to make that choice is that you're an attorney, your husband's an executive with a gas company, you guys are living middle to upper class, you're living a good life now. You can afford to make that choice.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it, unlike other cities, because in Detroit, I mean, we still could afford the same type of house, but there the lifestyle was color-coded. So in other words, all of our friends all lived in white communities because mm-hmm. we all wanted nice homes, you know, swimming tennis associations. We wanted beautiful, you know, the nice American dream type of lifestyle. And so we did not have the choice to have it white or have it black. Well, in Atlanta, you have the choice.
Yeah, Deidre said the most, one of the most, you know, you make, I spent a year making this film. And I traveled all throughout the country making these four parts. And there are four or five hallmarks, you know, moments of just keen insight. And one of them, Deidre turned to me and said, we wanted to be able to live with other black people and not have our property values fall completely apart. And that was so astonishing to me. I mean, there are very few neighborhoods where you could move in from, say, an upper middle class white neighborhood, be surrounded by nothing but black people, and your property values stay the same or increase rather than fall because of the racism of the marketplace for real estate. And so I understood exactly why they wanted to move there and, by extension, why Liza Gates wanted to go to Spelman.
Just a real quick question for you, Deirdre, before I let you go, and that is, do you see the choice that you and Gerald made as consistent or inconsistent with what Dr. King was saying 40 years ago?
I think it's very consistent because I see freedom ringing, because I see us being able to make a true choice of lifestyle, not based on color, and on where we want to live.
Mm-hmm. When we come back after the break, I'm actually going to listen to a little bit of that I Have a Dream speech, but I'm thinking of that point where he talks about little white children and little black children holding hands together. And Deirdre, can you see that ahead for your child?
I do. My sons are in schools that are still predominantly white, but they have enough African Americans in there so that they can see that they can make choices not just based on the color of their skin. They're free to, you know, not do just the traditional black sports or just appreciate the black music. They can feel free to enjoy the classical music or whatever they want because they see blacks doing a variety of things.
Deirdre, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the program.
Thank you.
Deirdre Wolfe is a lawyer speaking to us from her fancy new home in Atlanta, Georgia. We're going to come back after the break and listen to a little bit of that speech that I referenced. But we also want to hear from you, Connection listeners. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. What are you seeing in the neighborhood where you live? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
This is our hope. This is a faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day.
Well, I still get the chills. Oh, think of that man's voice.
Oh, I get tears in my eyes. And when I stood in the South sequence on the balcony where he was shot, I mean, it was one of the saddest moments, I think, for me. Just the end of a movement with one bullet. I mean, the civil rights movement did end on that balcony in Memphis. There's no question about that. And he was moving toward economic analysis. I mean, he had come to an understanding. He was such a brilliant, subtle man. He'd come to an understanding that what we thought of as racism for so long was really about economics. And racism was a metaphor for deeper economic or structural inequality, structural problems. And the series is about that. The series, W.E.B. Du Bois, everybody's hero in the black intellectual community, asked in 1900, what would the problem of the 20th century be? And he answered prophetically that the problem of the 20th century would be the problem of the color line. So I wanted to ask in this series, what would the problem of the 21st century be? And that's why I went around interviewing dozens and dozens of people. Unlike the lordly Du Bois, who just sat at his desk and decided, I wanted to ask people.
Do you know what struck me more than anything else was that it didn't matter whether or not you were on an army base at Fort Benning or talking to some hotshot Hollywood actor, you would always find a way of saying, okay, racism, measure it for me now. Where is it for you? And there is a kind of nice over-the-shoulder feel to that because you do establish a rapport with the people.
Thank you.
You can sit on this side of the microphone sometime. Showcase that. But what struck you about the answers that you heard, whether it was Hollywood or Chicago or New York City? What is it that sticks with you about what people were saying?
Two things. First of all, that it's the best of times, it's the worst of times for our people. Since that terrible day in 1968 when Dr. King was so brutally assassinated, the black middle class, people like Deidre and her husband, people like me, the black middle class has almost quadrupled in size, which is because of civil rights generally and affirmative action more specifically. But at the same time, the percentage of black children living at or beneath the poverty line is almost 40%. And it's hovered between 35 and 40% consistently since that day. That means that we have two classes within black America itself. That generally, we talk about the two classes of America, meaning black and white. But yes, black America has two classes, and they're both black. We have the black haves and the black have-nots. The second thing that once we analyze that, the second thing that struck me was that even the people in the inner city, even the people in the prison, the drug runners, as well as those of us in the middle class, had a similar analysis. There are two causes of our impoverishment. Structural forces, historical forces, racism, institutional discrimination on the one hand, but bad individual choices on the other hand. And the only way that we can free our people economically is to insist that each of us takes responsibility for her or his own individual behavior. Nobody makes you get pregnant when you're 16. Nobody, no white racist makes you sell drugs. No white racist makes you drop out of school or fail to do your homework. I mean, we can say that these are nightmare environments, which of course they are, but they're never going to change unless we attack, make the government start a sophisticated jobs program, in effect, a Marshall Plan for its city, for the cities, but simultaneously insist that every black person seize the opportunities, which have never been greater for our people, stay in school, defer gratification, and make your way from the working class into the middle class. The future of our people depends on it.
The interesting thing is, though, that when you talk to the black leaders, whether it's Colin Powell or Bernard Jordan, there is that sense that the people who have made it, who are the role models, have to stand a little bit taller as a role model mm-hmm. within the African-American community than anything that exists within the white community.
Absolutely. I asked Colin Powell, why should we have more of an obligation toward those left behind than our white counterpart? I mean, I don't hear you talking about the poor people in the Ozarks or in the hills of West Virginia, where I'm from. You know, I've never heard you do a program on that. What, do we have a special responsibility? I asked General Powell, and he said, absolutely. It is a relationship of part for whole. We are, as I laughingly say in the introduction to the book, what we thought we were in the late 60s when I went off to Yale. We were the vanguard. We were going to knock down those ivory-covered, cloistered walls of historically white elite institutions, and we were going to drag, kicking and screaming if necessary, all of our people in. Now, more realistically, as Franklin Raines, the CEO of Fannie Mae, he was the first black CEO of a Fortune 500 company. As he says in the film, the best that we could get would be an identical percentage of poor blacks and poor whites, rich blacks, and working class and middle class whites and blacks. But to do that would take an economic revolution.
Let's go to our phone lines. We've got a lot of people who are trying to join us here, too. Gregory, first, who's calling in from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Gregory, thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me. Great show. Listen, I agree. I see lots of blacks sort of starting their own neighborhoods, and some are even starting their own private schools. And I see this as a huge step backwards in what Dr. King was trying to do to assimilate all of us, Americans, blacks and whites and so forth. And I ask people, my black friends, you know, I say, well, does your child like going to all black school? Oh, sure, sure. And the reason they say is I want them to be more in tune with their own culture. I disagree somewhat because I think we have enough integration in this country where blacks, Latinos, Asians, whomever, can identify with their own culture without having to form their own communities and their own schools. So I do think we have taken a huge step backwards.
Do you think, Gregory, that there's any sort of pendulum thing happening here where because African Americans have the opportunity and the wherewithal to establish, you know, their own neighborhoods now, that the pendulum swings from the sort of white segregation on where it used to be to a black segregation where we may be in a few places now before it gets closer to the middle?
Well, I think so. And also, it's like he just said, you know, when Dr. King was killed, the civil rights movement sort of stopped. We had a situation where one time we couldn't go into certain neighborhoods and so forth and so on. The 70s and 80s and probably maybe the early 90s were good times. People were black people were really trying to move into integrated neighborhoods and to move up. Now they feel as though, well, you know, Dr. King did all this work. And so now we have reached the pinnacle and we don't have to worry about that anymore. It's all taken care of now. So
you're not agreeing with that, are you, Gregory?
No, not at all.
Oh, okay.
I live in an integrated neighborhood, and my children enjoy meeting people of other cultures and so forth. So I'm to the point that, yes, we have taken a step back, and I totally disagree with people that say, I need to go to a black school.
And Professor so Gates, you're torn about this as well.
Oh, I'm torn. I spent last spring, a year ago, looking for brownstones in Harlem, just because when I was thinking about leaving Harvard and going to Princeton, because I wanted to. I love Harlem. I mean, I love all the culture and history of Harlem. I feel the same way about Roxbury and areas in Dorchester. I mean, these rich historical cultural spaces. But there's no place like Harlem, of course. And to move there, I missed the first Harlem Renaissance. I decided I didn't want to miss the second Harlem Renaissance. But I wouldn't not want an all-black life or an all-black lifestyle. Some of my best friends, as it were, are white. I say that with humorously. But before that switchboard lights up. But you need, this is where I would ask Gregory to think about. You need a strong cultural base in American society. Harold Cruz pointed this out in his book, The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, which I write about in the introduction to the book. You need to be standing on a strong cultural base in order to be in a position to integrate, to reach out, to experience other cultures. You can't act as if you're not black. The first thing you see about me when I walk into a room is my blackness. Remember when I asked Colin Powell in the film about that? I said, General Powell, when you walk into Mideast peace talks and there's Sharon and Arafat sitting there, what's the first thing they see? Is it that you're a black man? He said, they see me as a black man. This is the curse that all of us of our generation and subsequent generations will suffer from for a while until racism disappears in America, which is, from the looks of it, is not going to disappear anytime soon. But then Powell went on to say, but then they see the power of the president, the American flag, and the greatest military machine in the history of the world. So that we have dual identities, but unless we stand on a strong cultural base, I don't think that we can function as full and equal citizens in a society where ethnicity is so very important. And you have to remember, too, I'm biased. I am the chairman of the Department of African and African American Studies at Harvard. I make my living teaching about the rich variety of black cultures, both in the old world and the new world.
1-800-423-8255 to Patricia next, who's calling in from Cambridge. Hi, Patricia. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I moved to Cambridge, actually, from Brownstone in Harlem. And I wanted to call in because
is it still for sale?
Yes. I had moved. I had lived in different places in Manhattan and grown up in a pretty affluent suburb outside of Buffalo. And so moving onto this block in Harlem was really the first interracial community that I had ever been a part of. When I moved there, I was about 27, so that was a pretty long time. But I just wanted to say that it was really an incredible experience. My one block consisted of just a variety of people, white and black. They were rich and they were poor, and it was just the closest community I've ever been a part of. I live in Cambridge now, and I'm not sure where I would find that experience again. And I think that part of the reason it worked was because the community really had its roots in and was established by the black families who had lived there for 30 or even 50 years. And maybe it worked because...
You're saying, Patricia, that the people who lived there or had lived there for a long time were so comfortable with
right.
their neighborhood that they didn't feel
threatened.
Even questioning or threatened or you know, wondering
exactly.
about your place there, right?
And I think that's why it worked, because I was being integrated into it, and also because they were just incredibly welcoming to me, which was a wonderful surprise. They're still some of my closest friends. And I feel Harlem is changing now, and I have complicated feelings about that and about maybe my part in it.
You mean because of the gentrification of Harlem?
Exactly. I began paying...
Because hotshot academics are coming down and paying too much for the brownstone.
Exactly. They're paying more rent, and so I think...
It's those white people moving in.
but you do have complicated feelings because I think it's such an incredible place. It's an incredible community, and I was just blessed to be welcomed into it.
Patricia, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you very much.
I want to hear from Maurice Ashley here. Maurice Ashley is the only black international chess grandmaster, features prominently in the America Beyond the Color Line PBS documentary that Henry Louis Gates has written and hosted. He's joining us now on the phone from Queens, New York. Maurice, thanks for being with us.
Hi, hello. Hi, Dick. Hi, Skip.
Hey, Maurice. How are you, my man?
I'm doing good, man. How are you?
You getting over the fact that I beat you so badly in chess, you know, that it humiliated you?
What fantasy was that?
Yeah. In my dreams.
You're listening along, Maurice, as we're talking about trying to measure the shift and the change, and as Professor Gates is saying, trying to put a marker down in this century to figure out the color line. What's the perspective that you would bring to this notion of, well, let me start with where we began, the idea that a lot of African Americans are moving back to the South, that, as Maya Angelou said, many of them who have lived in the North were actually living a life in exile in the North. How do you see that from your place in New York City?
Well, I find that intriguing because a lot of my family members are doing it also. My sister moved down to Florida with her three boys. A lot of my aunts and uncles are now in Georgia. My mother is going to be going down in a couple of years when she retires. So it is that feeling that there is that welcoming attitude that's really bringing a lot of African Americans back to the South. I live in Brooklyn for many years, and most recently in Park Slope. And Park Slope is a fairly well-to-do neighborhood in Brooklyn.
My daughters live there, Maurice. They just moved there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And it's essentially a well-to-do white, mainly white neighborhood. My daughter goes to school there, and we moved to St. Albans in Queens, where it's more African-American homes, middle class. And we do have that same complicated relationship with that, because my daughter still goes to school there. She commutes almost an hour to go to school because the school system is just is so much better. The school is so much better than anything in this neighborhood. And she's surrounded by white friends, and she's always had white friends. But there's something, again, a little comfortable about living in St. Albans, a different psychology, if you will, being around other African-Americans who are working hard, professionals. It's an interesting question of sort of deintegration, if you will, going backwards. I don't see it as going backwards, since we still have all, as I said, all these white friends. Some of my best friends are white. But there's something different about living around your own, and it's very hard to explain, but I think it's a real phenomenon.
Maurice, let me ask you a question about the kids who you have been mentoring in chess for these many years. You've seen kids who embrace the game and through that embrace education and have moved on and up, and I'm wondering what they're saying to you. If you can sort of tap us into that generation? What are they saying to you? Mr. Ashley, I'm doing this now, I'm going here now. What's the feedback you're getting?
Well, all these kids are about controlling their futures now. The sense that they have is that chess has shown them a way to tap into their intellectual capabilities and that they can do. They can move up. Most of the kids I've worked with have been in Harlem, and they come out of, again, there's the heritage in Harlem that's turning around now, naturally, the Renaissance, but there's also that toughness to Harlem where you go around certain blocks, you don't really want to walk down those blocks at night, and they see a lot of their friends ending up in jail mm-hmm. or being killed. But now using chess as a mechanism for intellectual growth and for control, I like this word, deferred gratification, and one thing that chess teaches, to plan for the future. And they see their futures in much brighter terms than they used to.
Maurice said something in our interview. It was just so much fun hanging out with Maurice in the schools where his program is instituted, which is conceived and executed by Daniel Rose, the great philanthropist.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about him in a minute. But Maurice said, you know, chess is a metaphor for life, for struggle, for achievement, because the power pieces are in the back row. And you have to figure out.
I'm glad you didn't say there's black on one side and white on the other.
No. They could be any color. But you have to figure out how you become a power piece.
Right.
Residing in the back row. And from how you transform yourself from a pawn to a queen, as it were, to how you protect your king. And they took one of the worst schools, if not the worst school, as judged by test scores. When they started this program where all the kids learn chess and chess becomes central to the curriculum. And now the school has the best test scores in the city in its class for middle school. I mean, it is remarkable. And it's all because of Maurice's genius. Maurice is like the Pied Piper there. And these kids are so intense on beating him and learning and using books to learn skill and strategy. He's a genius.
Maurice, I want to thank you for being with us on the program.
Thank you.
Maurice Ashley, international chess grandmaster, on the line there from Queens, New York. Connection listeners, we continue our conversation trying to make sense of the color line in this second century, since W.E.B. Du Bois drew our attention to it in the 20th century. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. How do you see it where you live? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me in the studio, Henry Louis Gates, Jr. He is the writer and presenter of a brand new PBS series, which you'll see on your PBS channel, coming up at the beginning of next month, February 3rd and 4th, if I'm not mistaken. It's called America Beyond the Color Line. And we're taking your calls as we try to, as he is here to help me make sense of what he's seen. We're going to go next to Boston, Massachusetts, and Bronze is joining us. Bronze, go ahead.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Number one, I'd like to make a point, as a black person originally from Birmingham, Alabama, who's moved to Boston, that the real issue is not why black people are moving back to the South. It's because there's more opportunity there. The real issue is that the talented 10th leaders, as expressed in Mr. Cruz's book, which you addressed earlier, mm-hmm. and expressed by Mr. Dubois many years ago, are letting down their people. The so-called intellectuals are letting down the so-called people and have been the main ones to take advantage of them in this northern Babylon. I don't want anyone out there to think, any black people, I'm black, I'm dark and black, from Alabama, to think that the so-called black leaders that are out here are doing anything but being the most enabling of the stripping of that culture, which they're moving back to the South for.
Be specific. Bronze, give me an example of what you're talking about.
Yeah,
here.
Like who?
Wonderful. I think that we can talk about, for instance, whom Africana.net was sold to. Sure wasn't a black company. Whom BET was sold to. Sumner Redstone. Sure in the black company. And look at what BET is putting out. And all of these people are all connected, from the owners of Vibe, which is a sewer, to the owners of BET, which were black, which is a sewer, to the owner of all of these things, which are sewers, destroying our people. The enablers of our destruction are the enablers supposed to be.
So you're talking about corporate black leaders.
No, I'm talking, look, every corporation has a head. Should I name names?
No, we don't need to go there.
Well, I would disagree. I think that I think that we've never had a stronger black leadership and more diversified. That's why Program One is called Ebony Towers, and it is about this new black leadership, people like Colin Powell and Verna Jordan and Franklin Raines and Quincy Jones. And
he's done so much for black people other than giving us a bad name around the world as enabling destruction in Iraq.
I think Colin Powell is a model of intellectual excellence and integrity for
model of intellectual and integrity. Excellence and integrity. You said that.
I said
nothing integrated about Colin Powell other than his enabling the justification of the death of Iraqis.
I didn't say that I agreed with.
If
I may finish, I didn't say that I agreed with all of Colin Powell's policies, and God knows I don't agree with the Bush administration, but I know Colin Powell. He is a man of tremendous integrity and commitment to our people. You don't have to. There are 35 million black people, brother. There are 35 million ways to be black. We could have right-wing black people, centrist black people, left-wing black people. As a department chair at a major university, I'm keenly aware of that. You know, there's not one way of being black, and that's old guard's thinking. I mean, that we're all going to think alike. Colin Powell is a down black man, and I will defend his right to be Colin Powell, and I'm proud of him. I would, if I were in charge, not be in Iraq. I would have different policies than the Bush administration, but I'm not in charge. I mean, he has a right to do his job as he sees fit, and that doesn't allow any of us to kick him out of the race.
1-800-423-8255. Next on the line, where are we going? We're going to Dan in Spokane, Washington. Hi, Dan. Thanks for calling.
Good morning.
Hey, Dan.
Here's what I'm hearing. I'm hearing this morning that upper class, better educated, of course, and wealthier black and white Americans are able to integrate. And it looks and sounds or feels to me as if lower class black and white Americans just can't do it. How does that score with y'all?
Well, I'm glad you raised this. One program is called The Streets of Heaven. And it's about the infamous Robert Taylor homes on the south side of Chicago. In fact, they are being torn down. And so we documented that. We filmed there while they were being torn down. At one point, the average age of a grandmother in the Robert Taylor homes was in her mid-30s, a grandmother. Today in Chicago, 45% of all black men between the ages of 20 and 24 are out of work and out of school.
What do you say? One in five is either in jail or on parole?
In five, 20%. In prison, on probation, or parole. 69% of all black homes in Chicago are headed by single parents.
But you know what I want to do with Dan's question, though, is apply this test that he's asking us about. Is that a color line or is that a class line?
That is a class line that is compounded by color and a color line that is determined by the delimitation of class. The two are class and color have been ground together in a crucible of misery such that we don't know where one starts and one stops. That's why we need this two-prong attack to end the extreme poverty in the black community. The creation of the reform of our schools, the creation of after-school programs for inner-city kids that teach not only African-American culture but computers and the ABCs. But we also need the individual accountability. We need our leaders to help our kids understand that learning was the blackest thing that you could do in the civil rights era, that it was a way of defeating white racism, that staying in school and mastering the ABCs was a way of giving it to George Wallace and Orville Faubus, that the slaves, as Frederick Douglass famously put it, had to steal a little learning from the white man. Learning is what we were all about, but somehow we've come to this dead end where for a huge segment of our people, learning, getting straight A's in school is white, speaking standard English is white, visiting the Smithsonian, white, going to art museums, white. It's becoming a nerd, and becoming a nerd is not cool. It doesn't fit in with the image of the hip-hop huckster who is, you know, the Mac Daddy around town. This is killing our people. And I'm not for censoring those images. I'm saying we have to have civil rights leadership in this country, just as charismatic, just as determined, just as honest as Dr. King, who will help us understand that the next face of the civil rights movement will be defined by education and seizing economic opportunity.
Dan's still with us on the line. Are you saying that that civil rights movement needs to be as specifically addressing the class question that he's asking as it addresses the color
Absolutely.
Question?
Absolutely. Dr. King did not die the morning after a civil rights rally. He died the morning after a rally in support of garbage workers for more wages. He had moved to an economic analysis. And we all have to move to an economic analysis. That's the moral of the film, the four-part series. That's the moral of the book. Everybody, once we suspend for race, behind closed doors, when we lift the veil, as Du Bois put it, what were all of these people, whether it was Eric in the Cook County Jail or the Massenburgs in the Robert Taylor Homes or Vernon Jordan at 30 Rockefeller Plaza or Colin Powell at the Secretary of State's office, they were talking about, as Vernon said, the money, about economics, about the class divide within our community. And we can't wait any longer for a white deliverer, an Abraham Lincoln, to come galloping down the street to liberate us, because that ain't going to happen.
Dan, any last word from you?
Well, I happen to be, I guess what I would say, a lower, at best, lower middle class white American.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I live closer to the bottom end, if you will. And what I see is black and white Americans in the same pot to a certain extent, in that we're wondering where we're going to work, what kind of jobs we're going to have,
right,
if any. And I think then naturally there must then be quite a bit of competitive mistrust, one race for the other. And of course, with white America having for certainly 200 years or so stood on the necks of black Americans, there's a resentment, of course, and there's a lot of mistrust, and there's a lot more, I feel, a lot more uncertainty and competition at the lower end of the class level, and that's where it seems to me integration doesn't happen or work.
And you're right, that's where fears arise. Fears arise, and then the demonization of the other occurs. Precisely when the pie shrinks, and we are in an economy of the shrinking, the incredibly shrinking pie. That's why we need government and corporations to unite to figure out how to create that Marshall Plan for the cities that the National Urban League calls for. How do we give people a stake in the system? How do we guarantee employment for those who are willing to study and work and earn it? I mean, not everybody's going to be living in Deidre's and Gerald's neighborhood, but how can they keep their dignity, have health insurance, live in safe neighborhoods? This should be a fundamental right for all Americans, black or white. And if not, as this gentleman says, people then start to hate each other. They are afraid of each other. They're afraid. Those blacks are getting things they don't deserve, and they're taking away from me, and why should that be? I'm not responsible for slavery. They're being manipulated by the economic climate and by demagogues.
Okay, but we're in the middle of an election year, Skip, when the people who want to lead this country should be addressing these things specifically.
Yeah, they're not. And I think that they have failed to stand up to the real call of leadership. You know, the best person on the campaign trail is Al Sharpton. Now, Al Sharpton, in those debates, is funny, witty, and saying things that the others are too frightened to say. It's astonishing. But, you know, Sharpton has been enjoying the tutelage and friendship and companionship of Cornel West for a long time, and I think that it shows. I mean, he's very articulate. He has no chance at all of ever being president of the United States. He has a checkered past with all that Tawana Brawley stuff, which is just an embarrassment. But he is a refreshing voice, don't you think?
I like listening to him whenever he's on, and I always think when he's speaking, and so, because he's because his candidacy, like three or four of them there, is kind of like, yeah, but. You know what I mean?
You know, it's entirely symbolic.
Yeah.
But if it helps to focus people's attention on these issues, then that, I think, will be a good thing.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Sure.
Dedicate America Behind the Color Line to your former colleague, Cornel West.
Yeah, I did.
I'm wondering whether or not you're missing him.
I miss him. I dedicated it to Cornel because he called me, left me a voicemail message 2 days ago and said, Brother Skip, I just heard you dedicated the book to me. Thank you, man. That was so nice. He's such a sweet man. Harvard was a better place with Cornel West in it. This book and this film series are all about the class divide in the black community. And the person who first made me aware of that was Cornel West. And then later through the work of William Julius Wilson, my other colleague at Harvard. And so I thought it was only appropriate that I wanted to show him I've been a good student. All those
you were paying attention.
Sessions well. And right at bars in Harvard Square when he was saying, "Brother Skip, you got to think about class." I wanted him to know that I was listening.
Let me ask you something else. The book that takes us through the PBS series, the year that you spent putting that film together. Did you surprise yourself? Did you come across something that you didn't expect to find when you set out across this country interviewing people north, south, east, west?
Yeah, I two things. One, I discovered how articulate the oppressed are about their oppression. I mean, that these are not unthinking, unfeeling people. I mean, these are people who know that they've made bad choices. They know they're victims of white racism and institutional discrimination, and they know that a two-prong attack is necessary in order to get them out of this situation. The other thing, the most incredible surprise I had, I think, was from the great Hollywood producer Arnon Milchan, who broke down the economics of racism in Hollywood. And he said, Panic Room starring Jodie Foster, let's say it made $100 million. Then he looks at me on camera and says, if we had cast Halle Berry, the most it would have made was $50 million. If we had had a dark-complected actress, $10 million, $20 million. Same film. So I say, okay, Arnon, love story, Denzel and Halle. How much would it make? Brilliant script, everything. He said, it would make $50 million. I said, that's good. He said, that's bad. I said, why? He said, because they're both A-list actors. Halle gets $20 million. Denzel gets $20 million. That film will never be made. It was, I've never, and no one has ever, when I talked to, about this to other people in Hollywood, they had never heard the racism of the box office broken down in such explicit ways. And unfortunately, those things are true. But they're true, but they're changing, and a new generation of filmmakers like Spike Lee and Reginald Hudlin and John Singleton will, in fact, change it.
Well, Professor, you always make us think when you come in. Thanks a lot for dropping by.
Thanks. I had a lot of fun.
Professor Henry Louis Gates, Jr., Chair of Harvard African and African American Studies Department. The new documentary series, America Beyond the Color Line, airs February 3rd and 4th on PBS. Earlier in the program, we chatted with Deirdre Wolfe, a lawyer featured in the documentary, as well as that international chess grandmaster, Maurice Ashley. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.